The Navy captain, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, was the sixth man to walk on the moon. His academic background includes a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Management from Carnegie Mellon University, a Bachelor of Science from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, and a Doctor of Science in Aeronautics and Astronautics from MIT. In addition, he has received honorary doctorates in engineering from New Mexico State University, the University of Akron, Carnegie Mellon University, and he's also got a degree from Embry-Riddle University. Dr. Mitchell has received many awards and honors, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the USN Distinguished Medal, and three NASA Group Achievement Awards. He was inducted to the Space Hall of Fame in 1979 and the Astronaut Hall of Fame in 1998. After retiring from the Navy in 1972, Dr. Mitchell founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences to sponsor research into the nature of consciousness as it relates to cosmology. In 1984, he was a co-founder of the Association of Space Explorers, which is an international organization for those who have experienced space travel. He is also the author of Psychic Exploration and The Way of the Explorer. Dr. Mitchell has spent the last 30 years studying human consciousness, psychic and paranormal phenomena, in the search for a common ground between science and spirit. And he's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Dr. Mitchell, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good. How are you tonight?
Good, Edgar. It's been a long time since you and I talked.
Yes, it has been.
And what a day, too, with the passing of Gordon Cooper.
Yes, that was a sad day. I did hear about it earlier today, and he's a good friend and good colleague.
You were the second wave of astronauts during this just tremendous time in the United States space program. And, you know, Gordon Cooper and the pioneer of the other six who were there, really remarkable, I think, for what those seven did. Not to take anything away from the rest of the astronauts, many of whom walked on the moon, but in an era where no one really knew what was going to happen up there in space, they really took a chance, didn't they?
That's quite true. Yes, in the 50s, before the space program, no one had gone above 60,000 feet into the atmosphere. So it was total unknown. It was to the best of everyone's knowledge, it was a three-layered universe, God in the heavens, man in the middle, and everything else below.
He was a pretty cocky guy, too, wasn't he?
Yeah, Gordon felt pretty sure of himself. He was a great guy. He was fun to be with.
I love the line when somebody talked to him about who was the best pilot he ever knew. He said, "You're looking at him." You know, Edgar, when as a group, would you once in a while all get together at the different events and things like that?
Well, whenever we could. Over the years, there was many times when we were able to all get together. A lot more times when we weren't, but there was effort to try to get everybody together every so often. At major events in Washington or funerals or causes to celebrate, get back to Houston. Most of us go back and take our annual physical at one of these events. So when it was possible, we tried to get everybody together.
Well, history indeed.
These days, the Association of Space Explorers serves as a focal point, and many of the guys are able to get back for that every year somewhere, wherever we're going to meet them that particular year.
It's like a reunion group, isn't it?
Kind of, yeah.
You know, and what a day, too, with the passing of Gordon Cooper, and at the same time, very historic second flight into space by a private spaceship, Spaceship One.
That's an interesting, quite interesting.
Did you ever foresee the day where you thought we would have private enterprise going into space?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think it's been coming on. We have to do that. It will be done. I know quite a number of entrepreneurs that for a number of years have been planning this, trying to find the funds to make it happen, make it an economically viable venture. And also we need to have the legal infrastructure in place to somewhat manage this so it's not a free-for-all and when we go into space.
Oh, absolutely. And I guess one of the great applications, too, would be the travel time. Can you imagine going from, like, Los Angeles to New York? You just go up into space, and then you come back down again, and there you are.
Yeah. Yes, if we can orbit the Earth in 90 minutes, we should be able to have commercial travel around the world a little bit faster than we do at the moment.
Edgar, we've got a couple hours with you tonight, so I want to take advantage of the time that we do have with you. And I don't want to dwell on this because our big thrust with you tonight is going to be about the human mind, because I do want to talk about the experiments that you conducted when you were on Apollo 14. You've got a great story to tell us. I remember you telling me this in St. Louis years ago with Uri, about Uri Geller, which is just a wonderful story. But I have to ask you this, because of today with Gordon Cooper passing, and he was such a strong believer in extraterrestrial life, claiming himself to have seen UFOs, I wanted to get your reaction as an astronaut as well to that. I mean, was there a group of astronauts who were, I don't want to use offended with some of the things he said about UFOs, but were they uneasy about some of the things that he said?
Well, I certainly never was, because I know a lot of the details here that we'll talk about, I'm sure.
Yes.
But yes, I think some were. Some were a bit uncomfortable with that, and that's simply because the government has never been forthcoming about it, and there has been cover-up. There has been lack of candor, and that's hard to explain, but that's the way it is.
Do you know if Cooper was ever, or even yourself, I guess, were you ever told by someone in government, keep your mouth shut, don't say anything about this?
No, well, yes and no. It was common knowledge in the flight community, for both military and commercial aviation, that you make reports like this, your life's going to be miserable. Totally shut up, or promotions are denied. There were sanctions, and everyone that's in the aviation community over the years in the 50s, 60s, 70s, learned the hard way to just go on about your business and shut up.
Right. Well, now, sanctions, though, because they thought maybe everyone who saw these might have been nuts, or sanctions because they just wanted to keep it quiet?
I will go with the latter.
Yeah, that's what
and, I thought. And in the astronaut program itself, this was, we never even talked about it. It wasn't even an issue. But in the aviation community, it was.
And I remember you telling me that when you were on the moon, you did not see anything unusual.
No.
On the moon.
No. Well, in space, during the space flight aspect of my career, no. That's absolutely true.
I guess Cooper was one of the fortunate ones to be able to witness some strange things.
That's right. Gordon, in his aviation career, has had claimed, and I don't disbelieve it at all, had claimed to being in his Air Force, before he was in the astronaut program, being vectored toward unknown objects and trying to chase them down unsuccessfully. And then during a time when he was at Edwards Air Force Base on duty, he happened to observe a phenomenon which he tried to get some interest in, but all of a sudden it disappeared in the black hole we call classification.
Ever since I first talked to you in 1998, when you were kind enough to be on my local show in St. Louis, when we talked about your book, The Way of the Explorer, which I still keep on my desk at home, by the way, I've always mentioned you on that program and also Coast to Coast as one of those people that I truly not only respect, but believe. And, you know, quite honestly, Edgar, if you told me the sun was falling, coming from you, I'd believe the sun was falling.
You're very kind, George. Yes, I try to be factual. I try to tell it like it is. And there's a lot I don't know, but those things I do experience and do know, I'm not bashful about telling about.
Do you believe we've been visited?
Beg your pardon?
Do you believe we've been visited here?
Well, my best information says yes. I don't have personal first-hand smoking gun knowledge of that, but folk in the military and intelligence community, both of ancient times, whom I call the old-timers, and some relatively recent high-level people who have taken the time to do some investigation. They say yes.
All right, very good. Well, and thank you for telling us some of this, because, you know, I do know that the thrust of our interview tonight was to talk about the human mind, and we're going to live up to that with you, because you have done some tremendous work in that arena. At what point in your career, I mean, here you were, you were an astronaut, you're on your way to the moon, but before that, you're fascinated with the mind and what the mind can do. How did that all happen for you?
I guess it was in the mid-60s when, like most people in the scientific world, I was not very interested or was very dismissive of extraordinary phenomena. But then I got introduced to Dr. Ryan's work, J.B. Ryan's work at Duke, and called it parapsychology.
Mm-hmm.
I've come to dislike the word para, but because I don't think it's correct. Did enough investigation at that point to say, if this guy is correct, then we in science are derelict in not properly investigating him. And that was when I took the opportunity with a couple of my colleagues here on Earth, medical people who agreed to do the little personal spaceflight experiment just to see for ourselves whether it worked. It did.
You didn't tell NASA this, did you, at that point?
Beg your pardon?
You didn't tell NASA at that point that you were going to do a little mind experiment.
It was just a private experiment we were going to do, and it, as is often the case, got out of hand. And one of the participants told the press before we were ready, and that's the way it goes.
And if I recall, one of the things you wanted to see was that did space and time have anything to do with it, right?
Distance and distance, yeah. And to the extent one experiment can give you an answer, the answer is no, it had nothing to do with it. It worked, anyhow.
It did work. Can you tell us exactly what the experiment was?
Well, it was just a classic experiment that was had been used in the laboratory of thinking about the so-called Zener symbol, star, cross, wavy line, circle, square. And I had them written on a knee pad in a random order. And the folks, the participants here on Earth, attempting at stated times to write down the symbols in the order I was thinking about them, which they did with an accuracy subsequently determined, and such that chance could have produced those results one out of 3,000 times.
Oh, my.
Which is pretty significant.
Now, do you think space makes it easier, or did that have anything to do with it?
I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Okay. As you...
Well, specifically, George, we've come to understand, that these phenomena seem to be closely associated with quantum non-locality, which Einstein called spooky action at a distance. And so space and time doesn't seem to have much to do with it.
You started then putting together some tremendous work called the quantum hologram. Explain that.
Well,
it's a little technical.
It was discovered by someone else rather than me, but I recognized its impact as soon as I saw it. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what it is.
Well, most simply... it's been known since early in the 20th century that all matter emits and reabsorbs quanta of energy, photons of energy. matter is not like solid little ping pong balls down at the atomic level. It's fluctuating, flowing energy. And the photons of energy are being emitted and reabsorbed continuously.
Excuse me. Sure. Get yourself a little glass of water.
Yeah,
there,
I've got a cup of tea here.
There you go. That's what I always have a cold glass of water right next to me. See, I've got the benefit of a cough button, by the way. So
yeah,
I hit it, and nobody knows what I'm doing.
Any bit, the physicists have studied this phenomenon at the particle level for 75, 80 years here. But one of the things they didn't do until very recently was to study the phenomenon as a group phenomenon. In other words, that the difference is kind of looking at, noting that you have a little swirl on your finger, a little ridge on your finger, and then looking at it in a different way, say, oh, it's a group of swirls.
Right.
A pattern. Well, if you look at it as with group mathematics, it's a very complicated set of mathematics, look at group mathematics, it turns out that the pattern of emissions carries information about the object, historical information about the object. And that's called a quantum hologram. And that's a wow, because it elevates quantum information virtually to the level and the importance of energy itself. It's telling us something dramatic about the way nature preserves its information, its history.
And it always was that way, wasn't it?
It's always that way. So if we extend that conceptually a little bit and say nature's always been doing that, and we start to say, that seems to be an explanation for our so-called intuitive or psychic information, because all experiments have shown that to be a non-local phenomenon. In other words, non-local in the sense that it's communicated instantaneously and time, space-time doesn't make a difference. That's called non-locality.
Right.
Physics. And these bits of information or patterns of information, which patterns of energy, which we call information, have that characteristic. And that's a wow. And I recognized that the first time I saw this, and applied it to the notion, first of all, of psychic experience, and then to a larger notion of why we have conscious experience, subjective experience at all, and lo and behold, it fits, and that's a real wow.
Have you been able to, I guess, train your own mind to have these psychic abilities, these intuitive abilities?
Up to a certain point, yes. Well, we all have.
Yeah.
Up to a point. Yes, it is trainable. I have been able to become a bit more so. There's certainly champions at it, like we have Olympic athletes that are good, better at being athletes than some of the rest of us. And in this area, it's trainable, but some are, like Uri Geller, for example, are much better at doing it than the general public.
When we come back from this break, you've got to tell us about the story with Uri Geller. It's one of the greatest stories. I asked him to, he was my guest several months ago. He talked a little bit about it, but coming from you will really be something. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Edgar, when you look up at the moon every once in a while, do you pinch yourself and say, I was walking up there? Does that ever happen?
Well, not quite. It's still obviously a cause of amazement.
Yes.
We've done it. But it's fun. And with my children sometimes, they say, Dad, we really did, didn't we? Yeah, we did.
Oh, you know, I tell people when I get calls from people, the few who say, well, we didn't go to the moon. Yep. I said, no. I said, I believe Dr. Edgar Mitchell when he tells us he was there. He was. Does that bother you sometimes when people say that or think that?
Yes, it certainly does, particularly this modern group of naysayers. We used to have the older folk that, up in years, 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they couldn't get their mind around it, but that's not the modern hoaxers at all that are just out to make a buck and out to have their 15 minutes of fame.
Well, and here you guys are out there risking your lives and truly risking your lives. And, you know, then you have the people who are trying to debunk you. It's just plain wrong, I think.
Yeah, I've had it personally. And, of course, some of the other guys have been personally confronted with this, too.
Oh, yeah.
And it's it's not a pleasant experience, and it's very irritating.
Yeah, that's true, too. Neil Armstrong very rarely spoke about going to the moon. Did he do that by his own accord, or was he told also, don't say anything?
No, he's a very quiet, private man. He's always been that way. And that's just his personality, and that's great.
Uri Geller and you know each other. You relayed many years ago just a tremendous story about when you first met Geller. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that again, Edgar?
Well, there's a whole host of stories around the work with Geller. Let's just first point out that in spite of all things to the contrary, he is not a hoaxer or magician either, although I won't say he doesn't have the capability to be a magician, but most of the things he does are real.
Right.
And that's been demonstrated over and over again. I have quite a number of artifacts from those days. And it's very hard to, unless you have personally seen it and experienced all of this, it's very hard to believe somebody else's words on it. And I recognize that. But not only have I had some very personal things, which I'll explain very quickly here in just a second,
sure,
but we've done enough laboratory work under very well-controlled conditions, not only with Geller, but although he's kind of a champion at it, he's one of the best, with others also who have we've experienced this with. And where it really comes down to the most important practical application of all of this is it leads to understanding how mind and intentionality creates positive physical results or creates physical results. And that is something important for us to know about ourselves, about the way the universe is put together, about the way we're put together. That's what comes out of it. And in particularly in the ability to create ourselves a better, healthy, more healthy climate to heal ourselves. That's where we really go with that. Now, stage tricks or nice tricks like Uri Geller can do to show this is real, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not where it's going. Where it's going is the use of it in our daily lives to recognize that when you learn how to do and manage these types of faculties, mental faculties, that is, I believe, an evolving characteristic of our species that we can learn to use much better to help ourselves.
Tell us about the story of, was it a tie clasp?
Yeah, let's talk about that. Well, I had challenged Uri, if some of you may know, I had challenged Uri to bring back a camera I had on the moon that's still up there on the Met that's sitting on the lunar surface.
Did you forget it or what? No.
it was a part of...
you just took
actually, it's a part of dumping our excess equipment to reduce the weight. What I did forget and didn't get was the magazine off of it before. that wasn't so good. But anyhow, Uri had been saying how he was very good at teleportation. And I said, we were trying to do something else in the lab, and I was a little frustrated. I said, well, come on, if you're so good at teleportation, bring back the camera that's left on the moon. It's got a serial number, et cetera, and everybody will know about it. You'll be famous. Well, that didn't happen because it was still attached to a very heavy piece of equipment.
Uh-huh.
About a day or so later at the SRI cafeteria where we were working, had a group of us sitting around the table, and we were about finished with our lunch and going back to work, and we wanted some ice cream. And so he ordered some ice cream. It was brought to him in a metal dish, took a couple of bites, and all of a sudden cried out in pain. Blood came from his mouth.
Oh, my.
And he took out a glob of something out of his mouth and then washed it off in my water glass and said, oh, my heavens, it looks like a little emblem, a miniature hunting arrow with a ram's head on it. And I said, gentlemen, this looks like an emblem off of a tie pin I had that I lost on Apollo 16 before I ever met Uri Geller.
Jeez.
And so we chortled about, okay, what's the probability of something Ed Mitchell lost a couple of years ago, showing up in Uri Geller's ice cream when we're doing experiments in psychokinesis and teleportation.
And he would have had no idea that you lost this.
No. Not that I know. It was before I ever met him, and I hadn't thought about it.
Yeah.
So we went on about our business back into the lab. And I was in the inner lab starting to set up for the afternoon while the rest of them are chatting outside in the ante room. And suddenly I heard a plink on the tile floor outside, poked my head to see what was going on, just in time to see Dr. Harold Puthoff pick up something off the floor. And he said, "What's this?" and handed it to me. And it was the silver tie pin portion of that tie pin.
So you had the whole thing now.
Now we had the whole thing. The last time I had seen it, it was in one piece, but here it was in two pieces. And I pointed that out. I said, "Well, this was in the same jewelry box that I had lost before." And then so we laughed about that and went on to work. And see, this isn't science. This is anecdotal stuff. And so Puthoff and I walked into the inner lab and continued the work before we started getting set up before we really started the afternoon's work. And then while we were alone in the room, right between us, about shoulder length, we both caught something out of the corner of our eye dropping to the floor. I picked it up this time, and it turned out to be another tie pin, a tie tack. It was a put off. Said, "Well, what's that?" And I said, "Well, it looks like a pearl tie tack that my brother had given to me when he was in Okinawa on duty, or in Japan on duty a few years before for Christmas." And he said, "How do you know?" And I said, "Well, I don't know anything for sure. But note that it is a pearl stick pin or tie pin with a silver base and a brass clutch back." I said, "Well, the one my brother gave me had a silver clutch back, but I lost that one and put a brass clutch back on it from my Navy wing. And this is one with a pearl stick pin with a silver shank and a brass clutch back." And it was in the same jewel box with these other two pieces that we just recovered.
That's great.
So that's the story. And I still have those there.
That is
pretty
great.
Amazing.
You know, Captain, I was in the Navy 9 years. Just a lieutenant, though, for me.
Yeah.
I almost got my lieutenant commander stripes. One more year, and then I called it quits.
One more year, yeah.
That would have done that. Did you ever read the book Breakthrough to Creativity by Shafika Corregula? I don't know if you
ever... Yes. You know, of course. I knew her quite well.
She was my aunt.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's wonderful. I knew her back in the early days of...
She went to Oxford. And then she
went to Oxford, but she was also teaching at UCLA.
UCLA, that's right, and had a little private practice out there.
Right.
And
yeah. She was a great lady, and I did enjoy her.
You were with the Ingalls Swan Group, I guess, at the time.
Yes, well, Ingalls Swan was a part of the work that they were doing at SRI with Puthoff and Targ and that whole group under CIA auspices in those days.
You see, and she died under what we still think were very questionable circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, and I looked at her death, which occurred years ago, and then all of a sudden we just had another one. As you know, you knew Dr. John Mack, didn't you?
Well, I knew John very, very well. Although there are some who have attached questions about John's death. I don't.
Probably just the drunk driver, like they said.
Just a drunk driver, and John probably stepped off the curb in England and looked the wrong way, as some of us do when we haven't been there for a while.
Yeah.
And just unfortunate. And I happen to know the people he was with shortly before that happened. It was he was at a dinner party following his lecture, I believe. He was giving a lecture on Lawrence of Arabia and had gone to a dinner party with mutual friends.
What a loss.
Who advised me of it. I knew of it within hours after it happened.
I mean, we can't afford to lose too many people like that.
No, John was a great one, and I'd worked with him. We consulted together on his research, and we knew each other quite well.
What did you think of his work, Edgar, in terms of investigating alien abductions? What did you think?
He was a very brave man because academically that cost him and a lot of criticism. And but he was bound determined to try to get to the bottom of it. And I encouraged him. I believe that if these people had this experience, whatever their experience was, and he called them experiencers. He didn't really, necessarily buy into their story, but he didn't discredit them either.
Right.
He wanted to know what's going on here, and he did a marvelous job of investigating the phenomenon, and took a lot of flack for it from his colleagues, academic colleagues, and in my opinion, did all of us a great service in bringing this to the fore.
Is it true that most of the astronauts who went to the moon came back with a different feeling of their own existence?
Yes, everybody was affected, George. And I think the more you had time to, like those of us, like myself, who were in the lunar module pilot position, who had less work to do coming home because most of our work was associated with the lunar surface and getting there and exploring.
That was your voice, by the way, I think we heard
right at the beginning. That was correct. Those of us who were in that position and had a little bit more time on the way home and less official duties to just look at the heavens were pretty profoundly affected by what we saw, just the context of seeing Earth, this beautiful little planet that we live on, within the setting, the greater setting of the Milky Way and the cosmos itself. It's an overwhelmingly powerful experience. As people, well, who have looked at pictures of Earth, I mean, those are the most published pictures in the history of the Earth.
Yeah.
And the answer question is why? Because it speaks to us at a very deep level of our origins, of who we are, what we are, how we got here, what's all this about. And, of course, that's exactly what most of us who have been in deep space and look back, that's the awed feeling that we get in asking those questions.
Though you were trained, and so your movements on the moon were deliberate and you knew what you had to do, I've got to ask you this, though, Edgar. I mean, there you are. You're on the moon. You're 200 plus thousand miles away from the Earth. You can look up and see the Earth. What's going through your mind at that moment?
Well, George, to the extent that you can steal a moment every now and then in order to be introspective and a tourist and gawk and wow, you do that. But during our official work, you're so busy. You're on a timeline. The clock is running. You have a checklist on your wrist that you're working against, and you're behind schedule all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't much time to do that. If you're going to get your job done, you got to stay at it. And most of us felt the pressure of the time. Sure, we tried to steal a moment or two, like Alan did with his golf shot near the end when we had finished all of our official work, and I did with throwing the javelin after his golf ball, and funny things like that, and then hanging onto the ladder on the landing strut and leaning way back so we could see Earth way directly overhead. Those were little moments of wow and awe and exploration and exclamation that we allowed ourselves, but otherwise you're working your tail off. Yeah.
Did you think for a moment, and of course this was Apollo 14 and you were the sixth man to walk on the moon, but did you think for a moment that you could step in an area and just go right down, all the way down?
No, because we knew it was a solid planet. The whole thing was to, at least that's what we suspected, and that thought we understood a little bit about it, and that was the whole purpose of our science, was to confirm that, to get more information, to figure out exactly what the moon was all about and how that fit into our pattern of being on Earth and a part of our environment.
What I mean, when you looked out over the moon, I mean, was it, did it have that grayish look all over the place, or did it have any other color to it?
Depends. Yeah, the color was dependent upon your sun angle. So it could be those earth shades, brownish hues, gray, mouse gray, brownish. But occasionally there were splashes of color. We found white rocks, and there were in some of the other missions they found some of different colors. But by and large, you're looking at a material that's fundamentally basalt, lava rock. And that's the primary constituent constituents of the lunar surface. And that's because the lighter elements like oxygen and hydrogen, being light, had blown away, gone away very early in the process, or boiled off. And the gravitation of the moon isn't strong enough to hold them there. So it has no atmosphere. It does not have the lighter chemicals, which makes it somewhat different than the geologic processes of our Earth.
Would you have freaked out if you had seen a spaceship there from a past Earth civilization?
I think we'd been a little surprised. Right? Yeah, that was not in their in our game plan, not in our briefing, not in our understanding.
I've always wondered if we had civilizations way gone back that had the capability of doing that.
Well, I suspect that that is true.
Really?
Well, not necessarily on the moon, but you can't exclude that.
Ah.
I think if we have been visited, which it seems that we have, that the civilizations of our Milky Way or our galaxy,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps even other galaxies, which we have no knowledge of, really, could go back several thousands of years earlier than we. We're kind of perhaps Johnny Newcomers on the block. Geologic time, now if you accept the Big Bang theory, we're talking about some 12 to 15 billion years since the beginning of the universe, which it's under question these days.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm one who's questioning it. But nevertheless, that's ample time for other civilizations to be a few million years ahead of us. And if they were so ahead of us that far, the likelihood is that they've discovered us, and the evidence seems to suggest so. So we are perhaps in our vicinity, the new kids on the block.
Stay with us, Edward. We'll be back in a moment. And as you got into more and more investigating, you've also now taken really a profound look at this planet and what we as individuals can do to contribute. We'll talk with you a little bit about that when we come back. And then at the moment, sometime of this hour, we'll open up the phone lines as well, because you might have a question for Dr. Edgar Mitchell, somebody that I respect really, quite frankly, more than anybody that I know right now. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, along with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, and, of course, your phone calls that we will take this hour. Then I'll have pure open lines next hour. Dr. Mitchell, as we advance as a society where technology just really gets faster and faster and faster, what does that do to the individual? Does he lose control over what's going on?
Well, to a certain extent. But what it really forces us is to become better educated, very knowledgeable, better able to use the technologies. But there's really a deeper issue here, George. The deeper issue is we have always, unfortunately, tended to use our genius and technologies for our detriment rather than our betterment always.
True.
We end up creating more weapons of destruction to kill ourselves with and others. And to me, that's something we've got to learn how not to do. We have to evolve along our value system, along with the genius of our technologies. And that is a message I've worked on all of this time. And it seems to be rooted in my opinion, rooted in the transcendent experience, which I believe is the root of all religion. And it's what happened to some of us in space when you start to see this planet from a different perspective. And to me, that's the message we have to concentrate on here.
You know, it would be
We do not have a sustainable civilization, and we're rapidly running ourselves into the ground, and we've got to correct that.
That's true. It's too bad we can't take everyone into space to see what you saw, because I think they'd all come back with a different perspective.
That is one of the things most of us said. If we could have our leadership, our governmental, national leadership of all nations have a summit meeting in space, we might have quite a different society on Earth.
Yeah, that's so true. So true indeed. You, in your early days of developing the model for consciousness, you called it a dyadic model?
Well, it's a model, yes. It's a model that I worked out, and I think it gives us a basis for a cosmology. And it's essentially one, and it's a very simple idea, but it seems to work very well. It is that almost 400 years ago, the Cartesian model, due to René Descartes, essentially said body, mind, physicality, spirituality are of two different realms, the natural, the supernatural. And quantum mechanics has helped us see that's really not so, that if we look at it from the point of view of energy, that frozen energy we call matter.
Mm-hmm.
When it's condensed, this little stuff we call matter. Patterns of energy we call information. And so here is the same thing, energy, which we look at it in two different ways. And we can also say that we exist because we have matter, but we know because we can process information. So existing and knowing are very fundamental characteristics of ourselves and the universe that we live in. It knows itself. And if we use that as a basis for asking the question, who are we, how do we get here, we are doing a pretty good job of creating a quantum cosmology around that that seems to explain most of how we are.
When you were in space, to you personally, what was the most profound thing that you witnessed?
Just what we're talking about. Perceiving the universe and ourselves and trying to see it in a new perspective. Let me state it in the simple possible terms. Every generation throughout recorded history, all time, humans have asked the question, who are we? How did we get here? And where's all this going? What's this all about? How do I fit into my environment? And now that we're a spacefaring civilization, get out of our planet, look at ourselves like getting out of the trees to look at the forest, we need to re-ask that question again. And that's what I've spent a lifetime doing now that I've come back.
And you're not done.
And not done.
You're not done. Let's go to some phones while we still have you for the rest of this hour. Let's go to East of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast, you're on with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Hi there.
Yes. Hello.
Yes.
George. Hello, George.
Hi.
Pleasure to speak with you. First time on your program.
Well, thank you. Go ahead.
Dr. Mitchell.
Yes.
I hope you can hear me okay.
Yes, we can.
Go ahead.
Okay,
I don't know how well you knew Alan Shepard. I was talking to him on the phone many, many years ago. One of the reasons why I called you was him. You claim to have seen some craft from your Gemini.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble with that last statement. Say again.
You claim to have seen some craft from your Gemini.
No, I don't think he was.
I didn't have any. I was not on the Gemini program.
No, you're
What is it you think that Cooper saw? Was it a being like you or like me or what?
I'm. What Cooper saw?
He claimed to have seen something.
I don't know of anyone that has claimed to have seen anything during spaceflight. Only in the. In their aviation experience, I do not know of any so-called sightings during space experience.
Yeah, there was one thing. He did not see a being, but he saw some kind of an object when he was up in his Mercury capsule, apparently, that was tracked on radar, but no further follow-up was ever done with that. I think NBC was covering that flight, and apparently they tried to ask him some questions at that time, and he wasn't allowed to say anything.
I don't remember that
right.
incident at all.
Would that have been unusual, Edgar, at that point, to have for NASA to say to astronauts, "You don't talk"? Would that have been standard procedure?
I have never heard that myself.
Okay, first time caller.
Everybody said it to me. Yeah.
Right, first time caller line. Welcome to Coast. How are you there?
How are you?
Good, good. Go ahead, sir.
My name is Bud. I'm from Battle Creek. I remember back when I was in my 20s. You know, around the first launches and the, you know, when they were going back and forth to the moon there.
Yep.
I'm not sure which moon launch it was, but I used to always sit and watch Walter Cronkite and this other man, which was a guest on the show there a while back. He used to sit with Walter Cronkite, and they would talk, you know, and narrate stuff and everything, and you could hear them talking to the space people in the background. And one time they were sitting there talking, Walter Cronkite was, and you could hear him in the background, and you heard the astronaut call down to Houston and said, "Houston, we've got a bogey out here," and they instantly cut the feed off to where we couldn't hear it, and you could see Walter Cronkite had heard it clear as a bell, because he was looking past the cameras, and he said, "Did anybody else hear that?" And, you know, they were talking in the background there. You could hear them talking, you know, but we never got any answer on it or nothing. Did you guys ever remember that or anything about that?
Well, there's been stories like that all along. I'm not familiar with any of them.
Well, I was watching.
I was in mission control when some of these things were purported to have been said, and as far as I know, they never happened.
Well, yeah, but I was watching this, and Walter Cronkite was sitting there, and he was talking, and I believe the man that was on the show there a while back was sitting next to him, because you guys were saying he always was there, and I tried to call them, but I missed him. He'd already gotten off the show, so I couldn't ask him, but I remember it clear as a bell, because you could see Walter Cronkite was really, you know, trying to hear and listen, and that's when he realized they cut the feed off, you know, and yeah, but you heard it clear as a bell. He said, "Houston, we've got a bogey out here," and they cut the feed off.
It was Wally Schirra who was always with Cronkite, wasn't he, Edgar?
Quite often, yeah. Wally was on, yeah.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, a goofy question first. How far did that golf ball really go?
Well, I have a picture taken from the lunar module capsule,
uh-huh.
A window. And if you'll recall, most people don't remember, but I threw a used piece of equipment, a staff for the solar wind experiment, after the golf ball. I used it as a javelin. We call that the first lunar Olympics, a golf shot and a javelin throw. And I have a picture of them lying about 50 feet away in a crater with Alan's golf ball about 3 inches behind my javelin. So my javelin out threw his golf ball by about 3 inches.
and
I have a picture to prove it.
If he did that on the moon, I wonder how bad his shot would have been on the planet, huh?
Well, a one-arm swing, give him credit, yeah. A one-arm swing in a pressure suit isn't the easiest way to swing a golf shot.
That's true.
But when he kept claiming, and I've told him this to his face, so I can say it here, when he kept claiming miles and miles, and then every year it got another miles and miles and miles. I have to bring out that picture. Say, Alan, you're stretching it.
Yeah, it's the fish story, right?
Yeah, good story.
Yep. Go ahead, Dave. Finish up.
Okay. You gave an analysis of the rock. Now, did you collect also moon dust, the supposed dust you were going to sink into originally?
Well, we took some core tube samples that we drove into the surface and got as much surface as we could, and the lunar dust was fairly, like sand, it was fairly thick. We couldn't get to the bottom of it. But yes, it was very dusty. It was very fine powder. And we got samples of that as well as rocks, and as well as more compacted rocks, yeah.
Did it contain a speculated U-113? I remember a guest George had on recently that said that.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
U-113 supposedly was some of the composition of the moon dust?
I don't recall that.
Okay.
All right, great. Thanks for your call. What were the temperatures like, Edgar, outside of the spacesuit?
Well, if you're in direct sunlight in the heat of the day, the temperature gets up pretty darn hot on the surface, over 200 degrees.
Oh, my.
But if you were to be there, which we tried to be off by the time that happened, but if you were there in a lunar night, it could get down close to minus 240 degrees. It could get down pretty cold.
Could you feel any of those major differences, whether you were on the surface or in the module?
A little bit, but generally you just cranked up your cooling or cranked it down, turned it down or turned it up. Now, my particular criterion, and we all had our own, was I wanted to work at a level where I didn't quite break a sweat. That that would be sapping your energy too fast. So you'd use your cooling devices to, if you were working hard, you'd turn it up so you wouldn't really break a sweat. And if you were resting or not working quite so hard, you could turn it down. But it maintained a fairly constant feeling and temperature inside the suit itself.
What kind of a jolt was it when it when the module took off from the surface of the moon?
Well, it was a equivalent of about 3G, except lunar G. It buckled your knees a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but it was okay. That was what we expected. We'd practice that.
Let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm Bob, calling from West L.A., listening on KOGO.
Sure. Hi, Bob.
I have a story that I'd love to share with Dr. Mitchell. It resembles his Tic Tac story. It's in three parts. The first one is going to the airport, getting there early, putting my airplane ticket in my inside pocket and saying to my brother, you're a witness, I put it in here just in case it's not there when the time comes. Well, when the time came, the ticket had disappeared, and it never showed up. I reported a lost ticket, got my money back. Cut to about 3 years later, working on a movie, my car keys disappeared. My very efficient assistant and I looked for an hour and a half all over the location.
Mm-hmm.
I finally said to her, drive me home, I've got a spare. Told her the story about the airplane ticket and said, with my luck, my car keys will appear on my front walk. Well, they were on the sidewalk in front of the house when I got home, which was totally impossible. A few months ago, my car keys again, different car keys, disappeared for about 4 days. And one day going out to get the mail, putting down the books on the little stone wall next to the mailbox, I got the mail, picked up the books, and there were my car keys, which was impossible because I'd gone there every day for the mail.
Well, those are called apports.
Where do you go with that? Nobody quite believes it.
Seems to happen like that from sometimes. They morph themselves into salt shakers or whatever else that you're looking at, and then until you look again, then they're your car keys.
Now, when I go to look for something, I'm never sure if I've really misplaced it or if it'll just appear.
Yeah.
I think we've all had some experiences like this. At least a lot of us.
Anyway, thanks.
All right, thanks. Where do these objects go, Edgar? I mean, when they disappear, are they in some other dimension?
I don't think so. I don't think we can answer those questions without a lot of specifics here, and I'm not prepared to answer that.
Yeah, I would guess that most of it can be explained by absent-mindedness
exactly.
of all of us.
Yeah, most of it can be explained by absent-mindedness. But there are some that are so mysterious, like you described. I've had some myself that it just makes you scratch your head, and you say, well, maybe someday I'll understand.
First-time caller line, you're on with Dr. Mitchell. Hi there.
Hi, Scott, and I'm in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Hi, Scott.
Dr. Mitchell, first off, I want to I want to thank you, sir, for being a true American hero. I grew up in the space age as a kid and a teenager. I remember laying in a Florida hotel room when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, and you men were role models to me, and I just want to thank you. This is a true honor to be able to speak with you.
You're very kind. Thank you.
I just have three quick questions I wanted to ask you. How did it feel? You were on Apollo 14, knowing what happened with Apollo 13. What was that like, having to deal with that and, you know, the trouble and everything that they had? I don't remember. What was the gap between the Apollo 13 and whenever yours was launched?
Well, you first have to realize that Apollo 13 was initially our flight. And when Alan Shepard came on the crew to replace Gordon Cooper, who retired at that point, we were assigned to Apollo 13. And then because Alan had some had Meniere's syndrome, an inner ear problem that had grounded him for a number of years, headquarters suggested that maybe we needed a little more training time, and would maybe we better take Apollo 14 instead of 13 and let Jim Lovell's crew take 13. We didn't particularly like that at the time, but as it turned out, we got they got a bad bird and we got the good one. So for us, it worked out well for Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes and Ken Mattingly, who got bumped, as if you remember the story, got bumped because he was exposed to measles from Charlie Duke's kids. And Jack Swigert, who was Ken's backup, it didn't work out so good. But that's the story. So for us, it was wait until we checked all that out and get a good bird and go do the job that we might have done had we been successful on Apollo 13.
Well, thank you about that. Next thing I want to ask you was, do you know how many, or I know that y'all, I'm sure y'all have like reunions, out of the original crews from Apollo, I know Apollo 1 burned, but the Apollo missions from the initial ones circling the moon up until landing, do you know about how many of your crews or how many of your people are still with us?
Sure. Well, since we lost Gordon Cooper yesterday, but he wasn't really on the Apollo crew. So the people who have gone to the moon, there were 24 total who went to the moon. There are 18 of us left. Of the 12 who walked on the moon, there are 9 of us left.
9. All pioneers.
So we've virtually, we have lost a third of the people that went to the moon.
All right, and welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, and your phone calls will have open lines next hour. Let's go back to the phones, Dr. Mitchell, if we may. Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast, you're on with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes.
Hello, Dr. Mitchell.
Hello there.
I understand, Dr. Mitchell, you grew up in Roswell, New Mexico.
Well, I lived there, yes. Either Roswell or Artesia, just a few miles down the road. My family was in the Pecos Valley basin there.
Yes, I'm sure you're familiar with the story about the 1947 alleged UFO crash. And and that the wreckage supposedly was taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, to the Foreign Technology Division. And it makes me recall many years ago, Art Bell played a taped interview with the late great senator from Arizona, Barry Goldwater. And Goldwater recounted his attempt to enter something called the Blue Room by getting an access clearance from General LeMay. And the reaction he got from General LeMay really caught him by surprise. LeMay made it very clear to Goldwater he's not going in there and never, ever to bring this up or mention it to anyone again. I was wondering if you're familiar with that story.
Yes, I'm quite familiar with it.
Yeah. Do you give much credence to the Blue Room story that our government actually is hiding the
I'm sorry, I didn't get that last statement.
Do you really believe that there is an elite group of perhaps Air Force scientists or civilian scientists working in under contract where they do have proof of crash wreckage, etc., that is being hidden to places like the Foreign Technology Division?
Well, somewhere. That's my understanding. I have had that confirmed to me also, and there have been other attempts, like Barry Goldwater's, to get into the inner sanctum, and it doesn't work. That is a part of the lore, and it's been tested, and as far as I know, it's true.
Why do you think the secrecy, Edgar? Why do you think they just are trying to keep it quiet?
Well, there might have been rationale for it 40, 50 years ago. I would say today it's more power and control, and these are my toys, and it's making me some money, and I'm going to protect it as best I can.
It's given us the technology that nobody else has, probably.
That's exactly right. It's a matter of power and control right now. Maybe 50 years ago there was truly concern that the public wasn't ready for this, that Also, military folk didn't really know how to protect us against it. They couldn't carry out their national security function. Those were all valid reasons. a long time ago. They're not valid anymore.
There's a young healer out there called Adam, and they call him, what, the Dream Healer?
Well, yes, that's kind of got the name attached, right?
Who is he? I mean, what does he do?
Well, I can't, I won't reveal his identity.
I understand.
He prefers to be more private. Just he's a young lad, and he needs to have some protection. But I've worked with him. I've helped train him. I've helped him to understand what he does.
Very gifted?
Very, very gifted, yeah. He is, for a young man, we've had some very, very good healers over the years. The older generation has passed on, or passing on, and getting up in years. And it's good to see some young ones coming along, of which young Adam represents that younger generation, and he's quite capable.
Are they hands-on type healing, that like that?
No, he at a distance.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, at a distance. And I've worked with him. I know it's valid.
He's been tested then?
Yep. He's in due course as he matures. He's already a young adult, but as he experiences this, for a few more years, I'm sure he's going to be very, very capable.
Yeah, he's getting better and better and better.
Better all the time, yeah.
Okay, east of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with Dr. Mitchell. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Mitchell. It's an honor to talk to you. My question was, what do you think is the direction NASA is going in these days, and what, if anything, would you change if you were in charge?
Well, I really think we do need a different direction. We need some new thinking here and some regrouping. And I think that the president's initiative, or stated initiative, to get us back to the moon and on to Mars will happen sooner or later. One of these days, that's probably going to happen. It's not going to happen right away.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate your call. Let's move on to our wild card line. It is your turn. You're on with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
Hello there.
I want to ask Doctor if he's familiar with the writings of Jim Mars when he quotes Buzz Aldrin, I do believe, when the Apollo missions were warned not to go back to the moon. Are you familiar?
I don't recall that one, no.
There's always been talk, Edgar, that the reason why we stopped going back to the moon was because we might have been told by aliens' intervention not to go back.
No. The reason we didn't go back to the moon was that the public said, ho-hum, what have you done for us now? We'd carried out President Kennedy's dictum to go to the moon and safely return. And the public, via Congress, said, okay, let's go do something else. So they cut off the funds, and we didn't go but the six landings that we made.
Did you ever want to go back into space? You know, John Glenn did.
People have asked me that, and my answer has always been yes, but I'm going to wait till I'm 100 and beat John's record.
how old are you now, by the way?
I'm 74.
Ah, you're still young. Interestingly enough,
let me comment on that. Interestingly enough, I happen to be a part of a longevity study program.
Oh, really?
And have been for quite a number of years. And in science, we're making some real strides at understanding aging, understanding life extension and longevity, and how to reduce DNA damage, which is what happens as we get older, and prolong life in that way. So there's some very interesting work that'll be coming out, and is ongoing work, that is helping us understand these issues much better. But if we're going to do that, if we're going to extend our lives, we're going to have to learn to protect our civilization better and get onto a sustainable path, and we're just not there yet.
No, we're a long way from there.
Long way from that.
Maybe we'll get you to Mars.
Well, okay, I'll go.
You would go, wouldn't you?
Of course.
Yeah, I'd go too. you can see with your connections, you can get me aboard with you.
All right, we'll try that.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
George, good evening. Eduardo in Los Angeles.
Hello,
good morning.
Eduardo.
Hello. Fine, thank you. Dr. Mitchell, this is an honor to speak to you.
Thank you.
Obviously, this power of healing, teleportation, et cetera, has been around for millennia.
The what, please? I'm just about to get that.
Oh, obviously this power of healing, teleportation, et cetera, has been around for millennia, and I hesitate to take this slant, and I'm not trying to knock anyone's beliefs or trying to promote my beliefs, but this knowledge, this unified field theory in conjunction with the power of intention,
mm-hmm.
was suppressed before by Western religions. And I think when they speak of the return of Jesus, I believe they are speaking of this knowledge and not so much a physical manifestation of Jesus. And I'm afraid that government may try again to suppress this knowledge that great teachers as yourself are able to validate through science. And I just wanted to know what you think about that, and I'll listen offline.
Well, I wouldn't say it quite that way myself, but I understand exactly what you're saying. Yes, conventional wisdom, political control, does seem to limit some of the more interesting advances we can make. And I would say there's academic politics as well. We humans, even though we talk about change, really kind of resist change. We like to keep the status quo. And that's one of our biggest problems. It's fairly much exemplified by a great scientist of the late 19th century, Max Planck, who said progress isn't made by convincing skeptics, but funeral by funeral. And that is actually the way things tend to happen.
You've written about what you call sustainability. Explain that a little bit.
Well, if we take a look at any measures of our civilization, of human activity, it's on an exponential growth curve, and I'm talking about things, the number of television sets, the amount of information, the population growth, etc. Any measure of human activity is on an exponential growth curve. Now, that means geometric progression. And if it doesn't take a genius mathematician to say that on a finite space, exponential growth cannot endure indefinitely. It has to come to a stop, has to flatten out, has to smooth out. And we don't see that at the moment. We see exponential growth. And in systems theory, it would mean we are a system far from equilibrium. That's like a river rushing down rapids and headed for a waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
That's where our civilization is. And unless we take knowledge of that and things like global warming, species extinction, buildup of garbage, loss of habitat, loss of the rainforest, you know, just name it. We know what the problems are, but we're not doing anything about it, significantly about it. Our government hasn't even endorsed the Kyoto Accords or the international attempts to try to bring this under control. And until we do, we're in real peril. It's that simple.
First time caller line, you're on with Dr. Mitchell. Hi there.
Hello there.
Yeah.
Dr. Mitchell, I'm a big fan of a National Geographic video called For All Mankind. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yes, I haven't seen it in a while, but yes, I remember.
Yeah, and which is, for people listening, it's a story about the astronauts who went to the moon and their very personal accounts of their experience. And I'm always struck by the astronauts who were so-called left behind and not able to go down on the moon. They didn't go with the Lem, but they were
stayed up in command. Yeah.
They were orbiting the moon. And I wonder if you could just comment on their experience. They had a lengthy time just to watch and listen to their fellow astronauts on the moon and look out at the Earth. And could you please comment on their experience?
Their own stories do it far better than I can. But the whole point was, yes, they had plenty of time alone in orbit to, they all had significant work. They were mapping the surface of the moon with high-definition cameras, HICON cameras they were called, and they had a lot of work to do up there too. And they need to be compared somewhat like the catcher and trapeze act. Without them, we could never have done what we did. And they performed an exceedingly valuable part of the mission. But their stories, you need to listen to their stories themselves. And they had magnificent experiences experiencing the despair and the loneliness of being alone for a couple of days or however long they were there on their particular mission, but at the same time witnessing the beauty of the universe, going into the blackness of behind the moon, the total isolation. They're poignant stories, and I recommend anybody that take the time to stop and listen to them.
What kind of a thrill was it, Edgar, the moment you had the module, the lander, on the surface? I mean, that must have been thrilling.
Yes. Well, you're down safely, and particularly since we had some failures on the way down that were a little hair-raising.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we'd accomplished that. We knew that the mission was going to be successful at this point, and so that was a thrill. And being explorers, we had reached our goal, and that's what explorers do, is to go where humans have never been before and report what they find. And it was obvious we had accomplished a major portion of our mission to finally get onto the Fra Mauro region, which is where Apollo 13 was going to go.
Right.
When they didn't get to finish that one.
Was there any sound while you were landing from the thrust of the rockets or anything like that?
Well, you can hear the vibrations through the spacecraft itself. But no, there's no sound.
No sound at all to carry.
It's an airless environment, so there's no sound except the vibrations that come up through the spacecraft. Sure, you can hear those.
So as you're walking on the surface of the moon, you've got this eerie quiet about the whole place, other than the radio transmissions, right?
Well, yes, except Houston's talking in your ear all the time.
Are they?
Yeah. We're in continual communication with Houston and, of course, the astronauts themselves in any particular mission. We're trained to describe what we're doing for the geologist and keep people posted exactly on where it is so they can follow the timeline. So there's a lot of chatter going on back and forth.
How close did you get to the crest of a crater, for example?
30, 40 feet.
Really?
It was only after the after the flight that we backtracked it by pictures. We weren't able to see exactly where we were. It's just the undulations of the lunar surface, like a sand duning effect, like being in the desert. One sand dune looks much like the other.
Right.
And we were right on the edge of the crater and simply couldn't tell it because of the duning.
I wonder how deep the crater was.
Well, it's fairly well known. It's about 750 feet deep, as I recall.
That's a pretty big hole, isn't it?
Pretty big hole, about 1,000 feet across, and 750. We wanted to take a look at. That's the only thing we missed was the human excitement of poking our nose over the edge of that crater and say, "Wow!"
Just to look down it.
Yeah, to look down. Right.
We got
all of the scientific objectives that we set out.
Wildcard line. You're on with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Hi there.
Hello there, Dr. Mitchell. It's sure a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you.
I have two questions, please. Did you know James Irwin?
Oh, I know Jim very well.
And Howard Elkins.
Who? Who's that
James
last name?
Irwin.
Well, he knows,
and Howard Elkins.
He knows
right?
Irwin.
Both of those fellows.
Howard Elkins.
Yes, he was in the service, and then he went with NASA for 20 years.
I vaguely remember. Of course, I knew Jim Irwin. He lived right next door to me when we were at the Space Center. Right down next door.
You know, he went looking for Noah's Ark several times.
Yes, I was aware of that.
And then he had open-heart surgery once or twice, and then he passed away.
I'm aware of that.
Yes, I figured you were.
Yep.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell.
All right, you're welcome. Thanks for your questions, too. Only about a minute or so left. The two books that you've got out, The Way of the Explorer, Psychic Exploration. Way of the Explorer, of course, you wrote about, 6 years ago, didn't you? Something like that?
The first edition was, it came out in 97, right?
Yeah, seven years ago. Yeah. Psychic Exploration, how about that?
That came out in 75, I believe.
That was the first, wasn't
it? That was the first one, right.
What do you do next, Edgar? What's on your plate these days?
Well, I'm working toward taking these notions we talked about, quantum holography, as a matter of fact, taking quantum science as it pertains to biology, consciousness, these human aspects of it, living aspects of it. which have not been studied. It's been considered to be a subatomic issue, and that turns out not to be true. It's important to all of us. That's where we're going with it, and that's what I'm doing at the moment, is raising funds and getting development going in the area of, let's call it, quantum biology.
Your website, edmitchellapollo14.com, and the 14 is just the number 14.
14, right.
Yep, linked up with coasttocoastam.com. And, Edgar, once again, thank you so much. I mean,
it's always a pleasure to be with you, George.
Enjoy talking with you. Thank you. Appreciate it.